The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
What is the difference between civility and politeness? And then, is God really good? You're listening to The Common Good. Happy Wednesday, friends. Welcome to The Common Good here on AM 1160, Hope for Your Life. My name is Brian Fromm. So glad to have you with us on this rainy and cold Wednesday afternoon. If you've missed any of our shows this week, go get the podcast wherever it is. Get your podcast. Just subscribe, rate, review. You can also find us online at 1160hope.com, Facebook, the Twitters, and Instagram at Common Good Talk. It's been a crazy week in my world. We are merging churches, as I've been telling you over the last couple of weeks. The last Sunday from my church at Four Corners Community Church in our warehouse was on Easter Sunday. We're merging with a church called Downers Grove Community Church. Their last Sunday was on Easter Sunday. We have merged together to become the Grove Church right there in Downers Grove. Would love to have you come join us if you're looking for a church and you're in the Downers Grove area. But man, has it been crazy. It's exhilarating. It's a ton of fun. But we like to joke that with every question that gets answered, five more questions come out. And so literally yesterday was kind of one of my first days of just working in the church and trying to get some stuff done. And I just put a Word document up and just started typing question after question after question. And yeah, it's a lot, but you could be praying for our church because this is a new venture, new identity, new name, all of it, and really believe that there's great potential here. This feels God ordained and exciting and a fun thing to be doing. And so excited. I'll keep you up to date on how things continue to go. We did Good Friday service together, did Easter separate, and then this Sunday is our first Sunday. And so really excited and looking forward to it. All right, Christianity Today, a fascinating article, something I hadn't really thought about. Alexandra Hudson, this was a little over, just a couple months ago. Jesus was civil, not polite. I hadn't really thought about the difference, but she says our world today is defined by two extremes, intense hostility on one hand and suffocating politeness on the other. Politeness is a technique, she writes. It reflects decorum, mores, manners, and etiquette. It is neither good nor bad itself, but it can be used for good or for ill depending on a person's motivation. At best, politeness can help mitigate the awkwardness, discomfort, and annoyance inherent in our social lives, but it'll only ever apply surface level fixes and will never be enough to help us navigate or resolve our most profound and important disagreements. I think we get that, right? Where it doesn't feel like politeness accomplishes anything, or it feels like politeness just kind of scratches the surface, or it's kind of that veneer on top of something. She writes, at its worst, politeness can make our disparities worse by fostering feelings of selfishness, pride, and superiority. By contrast, and this is where this article gets interesting, super long article, but this is where it gets interesting. By contrast, civility is a holistic disposition, one that our society desperately needs today. Civility is based on the fundamental truth that all human beings are created in God's image and are therefore worthy of basic respect. It sees everyone as inherently valuable and endowed with essential dignity, invoking a general regard for our neighbors and citizens. Civility is rooted in the mutual deference we owe one another as fellow humans and allows us to consider even our enemies as moral equals. Yet civility can be at odds with politeness, as it sometimes requires that we act in ways that many might consider impolite. She goes on to say Jesus himself spoke of the perils of politeness and the dangers of being inordinately focused on the polished outward appearance. And she goes on to say Jesus was civil. He showed civility, but he wasn't always polite. Obviously, the famous one was the turning over of the tables in the temple. But then there were other times Jesus was blunt with people. He confronted people. Christ taught that having the right disposition, a heart posture of genuine compassion and selfless love, matters more than complying with the rules of right conduct. Rule following alone cannot make a person good. Jesus showed us that while being good is more important than seeming good. Likewise, Paul warned Timothy to avoid people who have a form of godliness. Politeness is empty if not backed up with character, she goes on to say. And so, the answer is civility, that we need, gosh, I remember Jim Dennison a while back speaking of the need for civility. Do you remember we used to have him on all the time and he said, Respectfully, I Disagree was the name of his book. And it was... the idea of it was that we need to reclaim what it means to be civil. And that's what this article is about, that Jesus was civil. We can't control how others act, but we can align our motivations with the example that Christ set. And to go back to her definition of civility, it was this, that Jesus, he showed respect and because everybody was created in the image of God. There's a respect to the Imago Dei, right? Like every person I come in contact with is created in the image of God with great care, knit together in their mother's womb, and therefore intrinsically valuable and by extension deserving of civility, a disposition of civility. It doesn't mean I need to agree with them. It doesn't mean I don't argue with them, but it means I treat people with the respect. She wrote, civility is rooted in the mutual deference we owe one another as fellow humans and allows us to consider even our enemies as moral equals. So what are we longing for? What is our posture? What's your posture? Is it one of civility, where even in your disagreement, you're going to treat people with respect and treat them well? Or do we just put on a fake politeness, but then not show people respect? See, the one goes much deeper than the other. One is outward. The other is inward. Jesus taught us to treat people with civility and respect. All people. Doesn't mean we need to agree at all. That's not what the call is here, but the call is to treat people with respect. When you come across people who might look different than you, vote different than you, talk different than you, believe different from you, do you still treat them with the respect that says, but you've been created intrinsically valuable because of, not just because of what you believe or what you say, but because of who you are and who created you? Civility. Civility. I think it is something that we must be searching for and shooting for as Christians. Well, I want to talk about character. Now, I want to preface this by saying this has nothing to do necessarily with whom you're voting for. I get why people vote for President Trump. I totally get it. And if you're planning to vote for him, more power to you. I have a more difficult time just because of very specific issues with President Biden, but I'm not one of these people who believes no Christian can vote for President Biden either. So this is not about who you vote for. This is instead about the character of your words. This has actually nothing to do with the actual candidates, but it has to do with Christian leaders being consistent in their speech. Okay, evangelical leaders being consistent in their speech. And it just happens to do with what certain people said around President Clinton in 1998 and what they said about President Trump, then President Trump. So let me give you some examples. Here was one. This person said this in 1998. Character does matter. You can't run a family, let alone a country, without it. How foolish to believe that a person who lacks honesty and moral integrity is qualified to lead a nation and the world. This Christian leader then said in 2016, I'm not under any illusions that he's an outstanding moral example. It's a cliche, but true. We're electing a commander in chief, not a theologian in chief. That's the same person. 18 years apart. How about this one? Franklin Graham, 1998. Franklin Graham said this. But the God of the Bible, so remember 1998, we're right in the midst of Clinton Lewinsky, right? The God of the Bible says that what one does in private does matter. If he will lie to or mislead his wife and daughter, those with whom he is most intimate, what will prevent him from doing the same to the American public? Private conduct has public consequences. Franklin Graham in 2018, 20 years later, he is not president perfect. We certainly don't hold him up as the pastor of this nation, and he is not. But I appreciate the fact that the president does have a concern for Christian values. Here's another one, 1998. What we have come to find out, however, is that we have a man in the White House who has for his life a habit in which he is engaged, and that habit is a habit of lying and deception and hypocrisy. To put it simply, to have a ruler who is a liar is an extremely serious matter. Proverbs 29:12 says, God says if a ruler is given to lies, this is translated a number of ways, but this is the basic Hebrew of it. If a ruler is given to lies, all his servants become wicked. I don't think he should be the president. I think he has breached every position of dignity and integrity for that office that office would call for. This same person in 2020, nobody's perfect. If a brain surgeon is going to open my brain, I'm not too concerned about his moral life. The presidency is not a moral job. It's not a position of moral authority. Last one, Wayne Grudem in 1998. We reject the premise that violations of these ethical standards should be excused so long as a leader remains loyal to a particular political agenda and the nation is blessed by a strong economy. Same in 2020. I recognize, and evangelicals in general who support Donald Trump recognize, that he has character flaws, but they do not seem to us to be disqualifying. Character matters, but policy also matters. So this, again, has nothing to do with whom are you voting for. I think that is a private matter, and you could come to what you think is the best choice. You could decide these guys are right. It's not a matter of character. You could decide it's right. This is not a matter of, who is, it could just be a matter of policy. But my problem in these is that these are some of the most influential Christian leaders in the evangelical world. And it's documented that they said one thing in 1998 about President Clinton and then said almost the exact opposite about President Trump. And here's what I would like to say in our Christian leaders. Again, I don't care who you vote for. But what I would say about to our Christian leaders is be consistent in your messaging. Be consistent. If character matters greatly in 1998, then character matters greatly in 2020. If character doesn't matter that much in 2018, we're not electing a pastor, we're electing a president. If it's not that big a deal to you, then don't let it be a big deal in 1998. You can understand why people read these things and go, yeah, there's a lack of integrity in these Christian leaders and what they're saying. I believe character matters greatly in all forms of leadership. I think it should matter in the White House for both parties. But that's exactly it. It should matter to you for both parties or not matter to you for either party. But I certainly know character and integrity and your words need to matter in the Christian world that it is not okay at all to play games with what we say, to not be consistent in what we say when it looks like we're being inconsistent for the sake of somebody we want to vote for or not vote for and get out of office or get into office. Our standard needs to be so much higher than that, that no matter what, I'm going to let my yes be yes and my no be no. I'm going to be consistent with what I say. My words are going to matter. That whether I'm speaking of my friend or my enemy, you're going to know where I stand. And it's going to be consistent. Like, I don't know how you can talk about moral life matters greatly here, moral life doesn't matter at all here, and justify that. And if we're going to be loose with those kind of words, then people will think we're being loose with the words that really matter when we're talking about the gospel and we're talking about what it means to follow Jesus. They'll go, well, do you really mean it? Because I don't know that I can trust your words. Words matter greatly, especially for the Christ follower. Read the book of James. Our words matter immensely. We have to make sure to guard it. And we have to make sure that our inconsistencies are not giving other people the opportunity to doubt what we're saying about the gospel and about Jesus. Hopefully that makes sense. We're heading into a political world. Let's be careful about what we say. It is pretty nasty out there today. My kids' games keep getting canceled. There's snow on the ground. I was watching the Cubs game last night. Man, I'll go to any baseball games, but more power to you for the people who were there last night at Wrigley and also at US Cellular for the White Sox Braves game. It looked miserable. We've hit that time of year where it could be 70 degrees or it could be 30 degrees. And the last couple of days we've gotten the 30 degrees and wet, and more power to you if you're pushing through and being outside, but man, is it nasty out there. So hopefully it'll turn soon, right? That's the beauty of April in the Chicagoland area. It can turn to be 70 next week and sunny. And so that's what we're banking on. And at least summer is right around the corner. Well, I want to play a clip for us and discuss a surprising person who called himself a cultural Christian. And it's just bizarre, but it really kind of gets us thinking. His name is Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins is one of the most famous atheists in the world. He's a British guy. He wrote the book called The God Delusion, claiming religion was a deeply dividing force in the world. He's very clear that he, through his books and stuff, doesn't believe any of this stuff, right? So what you're going to hear in this clip, it's like 2.5 minutes long, is that Dawkins, in this interview, is going to talk about how he describes himself as a cultural Christian. As a cultural Christian. And it's odd to use religion for somebody like him to extol aspects of religion, like to try to say that cultural Christianity is better than, well, in this, he's talking about the alternative of Islam, but he's kind of saying, I like being part of a culture that is influenced most by Christianity. And this might seem like a good thing that he's saying, but I'm going to make the case that it's not. But before we do that, let's listen to what he has to say. This is Richard Dawkins, the famous atheist and author of The God Delusion.
Well, I must say I was slightly horrified to hear that Ramadan is being promoted instead. I do think that we are culturally a Christian country. I call myself a cultural Christian. I'm not a believer, but there's a distinction between being a believing Christian and being a cultural Christian. And so, you know, I love hymns and Christmas carols, and I sort of feel at home in the Christian ethos. I feel that we are a Christian country in that sense. It's true that statistically the number of people who actually believe in Christianity is going down, and I'm happy with that. But I would not be happy if, for example, we lost all our cathedrals and our beautiful parish churches. So I count myself a cultural Christian. I think it would matter if we, certainly if we substituted any alternative religion, that would be truly dreadful.
Well, which brings me to my supplementary point, which is that, as we know, church attendance is plummeting, but the erection of mosques across Europe, I think 6,000 are under construction, and there are many more, I mean, are being planned. So do you regard that as a problem? Do you think that matters?
Yes, I do, really. I mean, I have to choose my words carefully. I mean, if I had to choose between Christianity and Islam, I'd choose Christianity every single time. I mean, it seems to me to be a fundamentally decent religion in a way that I think Islam is not.
I think you're going to have to explain why you say that, Professor Dawkins. Why is Islam fundamentally not decent like Christianity?
Yes, I mean, the way women are treated. I mean, Christianity is not great about that. It's had its problems with female vicars and female bishops and things. But there's an active hostility to women, which is promoted, I think, by the holy books of Islam. I'm not talking about individual Muslims, who, of course, are quite different. But the doctrines of Islam, the Hadith and the Quran, is fundamentally hostile to women, hostile to gays. I find that I like to live in a culturally Christian country, although I do not believe a single word of the Christian faith.
All right, again, it's hard to get your mind around what he's saying. This is one of the most famous atheists of our day. And here he is saying, I don't believe anything of the faith, but I kind of like what the result is within our culture in general, but also as it is in contrast to Islam. And at first we might be like, man, this is cool. Richard Dawkins, an atheist, he's being affected by other Christians and he's seeing the value of it. And yeah, cheer it on. But I want to make the point that this is a bad thing. This is not something to be cheered on. In fact, for a couple different reasons. One, the idea of cultural Christianity is an unbiblical idea. This is not anything remotely in the Bible. To reject Jesus, but to embrace the faith, or the kind of the fruits of the faith, is not Christianity at all. It's moralism. Jesus, I'm going to use my own kind of interpretation here to say, Jesus regularly says, you're either for me or against me. You're either with me or not with me. And Dawkins has been very clear, I'm not with him. He said it in this clip, I don't believe a word of it. And so therefore, I don't even want to use the word Christian in what he's describing. And the second thing that we need to remember is that when Christianity is just kind of this watered down, accepted lifestyle, if you will, that he's describing, it takes the edge off of what the gospel is. That it's about Jesus. It's about not that we need better morals, but that we need a savior. And that's what he's missing here. And so I want to reject what Richard Dawkins is saying here. This is not a good thing. We're not trying to create cultural Christians. We want to reject cultural Christianity. And we want to embrace biblical Christianity, Christ-centered Christianity. And Dawkins has said, I reject that. And therefore, we could call him a cultural moralist. Whatever you want to call this, this is not Christianity. And we shouldn't be made to think like this is at all a good thing. It's a weird thing. It's really weird to hear this from, of all people, Richard Dawkins. All right. We just finished talking about cultural Christianity, Richard Dawkins, the God delusion, and kind of wanting to have your cake and eat it too. If you're Richard Dawkins, I don't want to have Jesus. I reject Jesus, but I want some of the fruit of Christianity. I want to have like the moralism of Christianity. And along a little bit of the same lines is this article, Church Without God, How Secular Congregations Fill a Need for Some Non-Religious Americans. A sociologist of religion explains how atheist churches are helping people find meaning and community, serving many of the same purposes as religious churches. Let me read some more for this. Today, almost 30% of adults in the United States say they have no religious affiliation, and only half attend worship services regularly. But not all forms of churches are on the decline, including secular congregations or what many call atheist churches. As a sociologist of religion who has spent 10 years studying non-religious communities, this author has found that atheist churches serve many of the same purposes. Their growth is evidence that religious decline doesn't necessarily mean a decline in community, ritual, or people's well-being. So what's an atheist church? Secular congregations often mimic religious organizations by using the language and structure of a church, such as meeting on Sundays or hearing a member's, quote, testimony, or by adapting religious language or practices in other ways. For example, there's a growing number of psychedelic churches that use drug use. There are also other secular organizations that promote the idea that people can live forever, such as the Church of Perpetual Life. However, atheist church organizations like the Sunday Assembly and the Oasis explicitly celebrate atheists' identities and beliefs, even though not everyone who attends identifies as an atheist. Testimonies and activities extol values like rational thinking and materialist philosophies, which promote the idea that only physical matter exists. There are longstanding humanists and ethical communities that promote secular worldviews. There's a Seattle Atheist Church, North Texas Church of Free Thought, Sunday Assembly and the Oasis. They have a network or tried to make the first atheist megachurch. And so basically the differentiation is nothing supernatural. They'll sing songs. They'll have testimonies. They'll even take donations. But so I want us to wrestle with this for a second. What's going on here? There's a professor says, whether the atheist church trend will continue remains to be seen. But such churches meet growth. Recent growth is evidence that they can work much like religious organizations to build community, cultivate rituals, and bolster well-being in a time of religious change. All right, couple different things here I would suggest. The first is this is weird. I kind of feel like they're describing it's like how I feel about a vegan burger, right? You're kind of missing the meat and what it's all about. It kind of feels like a club. But secondly, and I would say this is the most important thing that I take from this. I think this speaks to the opportunity that the actual church has right now. Because the actual church offers community, so does the secular church. That's what people are looking for. They offer community. They offer structure. We need to understand that people are lonely. We talked about that on the show yesterday. People are lonely. And they're getting lonelier by the generation. And the church has an opportunity to step in and provide the depth of community that people are looking for. That's what's driving this, is the need for community above ritual and other things. I think people are looking to be known and to know others. And so if they can organize around their atheist beliefs, then so be it. But the church has an opportunity to not put on a show, not put on programming, but to offer community, friendship, connection based around a common commitment in Jesus Christ. That's a commitment that runs super deep. So that's one. But secondly, what this lacks, these secular atheist churches lack, is transcendence. And eventually, people long for transcendence. They long for purpose. They long for meaning. They long for answers that go above what the secularist and the atheist can give. Right? If we believe that all truth is God's truth and that the gospel is, in fact, good news and true, then these atheist churches are not going to meet the needs that the people are looking for. They're not going to provide what the people are looking for, basically more than community and songs and testimonies, but transcendence and purpose, meaning. And friends, I would say between community and transcendence, the church must take up its call. The actual church must take up its call to take this good news into the world, to be the church, to invite other people in, into the community, but also go out and be the hands and feet of Jesus, to love our neighbors, and to live out as Christ, to live as Christ has called us to live. I see in this story an opportunity. People are searching for things in our culture right now. We get that. People are desperately searching to the point that they're making fake church, atheist church. And I pray that that would give us the opportunity or give us the motivation to go, wait a minute. People want what we're having. People want what we're talking about. But even more than that, they want transcendence to go along with their communities. And we have the answer in Jesus Christ. May we be bold. May we be bold in how we take that to the world. Let's live out these ideals, will we? It's been a good day. Really glad that you've been with us. Like we said, it's cold outside. It can be a discouraging time of year once it's supposed to be spring, but it turns cold. But let's continue to have that hope that we talked about earlier. Our hope is in the empty tomb. It's in the fact that he is risen. No matter what you are going through today, find hope in the fact that Jesus has risen from the dead. It's not just Easter Sunday. It's every day. Every day is lived in light of Easter Sunday. We are Easter Sunday people whose lives have been changed. Everything changes with three profound words. He is risen. And as we said, because he is risen, everything, my friends, changes. Everything changes. No matter what you're going through today, you can have hope. You can have stand. You can stand firm. You can know that there is victory in Jesus Christ. I want to end our show with a devotional from In Touch Ministries. Let me read this. In Touch Ministries is the ministry of Dr. Charles Stanley. He obviously has passed away, but his words continue. This devotional is called Put God's Priorities First. If we trust God and seek to honor him in our decisions, we'll have the chance to see him work mightily. He's taking this from 1 Kings chapter 3, verses 5 through 14. He writes, imagine if God showed up and said, what do you want? Ask and I'll give it to you. How would you answer? Most of us would ask for loved one's safety, enough money to meet our needs, or a long, healthy life. Solomon may have been tempted to name something similar, but he made a different request. What he wanted was an understanding heart so that he could serve God's people well. Solomon's life was full of personal needs and desires not so different from our own. But when given the opportunity to ask God for anything, he prioritized the Lord's concerns. God was so pleased with the request that he gave Solomon not only wisdom, but riches and honor as well. This encounter foreshadows Jesus' words in the Gospel of Matthew. Seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be provided to you. God won't necessarily give wealth, influence, or long life because we put his priorities first, but he will always be faithful to provide all we need according to his purposes. Solomon's heart was set on seeking God's kingdom and righteousness, and the Lord honored that in a multitude of ways, both tangible and intangible. When we make God's priorities our priorities, we too will have the chance to see him work mightily in our lives. Those are the words of Dr. Charles Stanley at In Touch Ministries. Looking at Solomon's prayer, he wanted an understanding heart so he could serve God's purposes well. What would we ask for? An understanding heart so that we would know how to serve God and serve his people well, so that we could see the this world through gospel lenses, if you will, so that we could see people and situations the way that God sees them. What a powerful prayer that would be. Lord, help me see this world the way you do. Help me view other people the way you do. Help me see situations the way that you do. Help me see myself the way that you do. Lord, let me seek you first. Seek first the kingdom of God, and all these things will be added to you. Do we believe that as we seek God with all that we have, as we make him the priority of our life, as we make his ways the priority of our lives, as we make following after him the priority of our life, do we believe that we would see him work in our lives, that we would see him work mightily? Because I don't think we trust that. That if I were to be able to grow in obedience, if I were to be able to grow in perspective, if I were able to grow in following after him, do I believe that even if I don't get things like wealth and influence or even a long life, that when I put his priorities first, that he will always be faithful to provide all that we need according to his purposes? That as I set my sights on his kingdom, his ways, that it's then that the book of John tells us that Jesus says we will find abundant life, life in the full, life that matters. Do we believe that to be the case? Because as we do, then we will seek his kingdom. We will seek his ways. What are you living for out there? Let's close our show that way. What are you living for? What's your priority? If you could be given anything, what would you ask for? Let us be challenged by these words today. That if I were given God's priorities, God's vision, God's way of seeing things, would I then know what true life is? Friends, what are you seeking? What is your heart's desire? What is deep in your soul? What are you longing for? Seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be provided for you. What are all these things? I think it's primarily God's presence. I think it's this abundant life that we speak of. When we make God's priorities ours, we too will have the chance to see him work mightily in our life. But instead, the priorities that we search after are usually the priorities of this world or the priorities of ourselves, our own self-interests. But at the heart of this, do we believe that obedience to Jesus and following after Jesus is a doorway to abundant life? Do we believe that it is a doorway to life to the full, as Jesus says in John chapter 10. Because if we believe that, we will follow Jesus with all that we have. But if we believe that it's burden, following Jesus is burden, but at least I get heaven and not hell, then we'll never follow him with any sort of passion or meaning. Do I believe following Jesus is a doorway that as I seek him, then I will find the things that really matter? True life will be provided for me. Friends, may we be men and women who seek after the Lord with all that we have. Well, I'm glad that you joined us today. Join us again tomorrow from 4 until 6 p.m. Until then, I hope that you have a wonderful night. My name is Brian Fromm. You've been listening to The Common Good here on AM 1160. Hope for your life.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.